Good morning. I'm delighted to see Bill Hayton here this morning. His son Jeff is a cartoonist, and so is he. And I actually have a project for one of the two of you. And it has to do with how this story of the split between Paul and Barnabas could be dealt with. So I've got three scenarios. The first is the grocery store tabloid scenario. How would you read about this as you were walking through the supermarket at Kroger's and you looked down and you saw a picture of a man with a black eye and it says, Paul gives Barnabas a black eye. Barnabas splits. Doesn't that sound just sort of tabloid-like? I mean, it's like woman has 120-pound baby. You know, might as well spice it up a little bit. Then there's the White House release. I thought the press agent ought to handle this for Barnabas and Paul and say, Barnabas finds challenging new role in Cyprus. Old friends part with embrace. Then here's the fairy tale version. Kids, I did this for you. Barnabas and Paul make up and they all live happily ever after. I think maybe I've chosen to title this a little differently, and that is, Man Proposes, God Disposes. It seems to me that that's a little closer to the truth, but it is interesting to me the way in which Luke presents this. And I have to tell you, I've found myself troubled this time. You know that I have taught this passage before. I remember speaking at a banquet on this. I remember speaking in an organization that I didn't realize was about to split, and I used this text. So I've been here several times. Maybe I helped them down their way with it. But Barnabas is a personal hero of mine, and that's why I find this text difficult. When you think back through the book of Acts, you have to say, this is a great man. Barnabas is a great man. Acts chapter 4, we read about the church and how they were caring for one another and they were selling parcels of property and they were laying those proceeds at the apostles' feet. And we know that Barnabas was listed as a particular illustration of the generosity of someone who cared about his brothers, sold a piece of property, and laid those proceeds at the apostles' feet. What a great man. In Acts chapter 9, Saul is confronted on the road to Damascus. God stops him in his tracks, and after he is converted, he begins to share the gospel in Damascus, and you know, the Jews don't want that for very long. And so eventually, Saul, still by name, finds his way to Jerusalem, and he wants to associate with the brothers, with the Christian community there. And they say, no way. We know about this guy, and we are not going to expose ourselves to getting hauled off to prison or death. And it's Barnabas who comes along, who takes Saul under his wing, and who introduces him to the church in a way because they trust Barnabas. Acts chapter 11. We read of the story of those heroic but unnamed individuals who go about preaching the gospel to Gentiles. And a church is born in Antioch. And the church in Jerusalem knows that they somehow need to respond to that. And the first thing that comes to their mind, the first name on their list is Barnabas. Barnabas is delighted to go. He is a man who is full of the Spirit. And he delights at the report and the opportunity to go and minister to those Gentiles in the church at Antioch. And one of the first things he does is to go search for Paul and bring him and add him to the ministry team that is there in the church at Antioch. And then we know, of course, oh, and by the way, late Acts chapter 11, you remember the story of Agabus, the prophet, who comes down and says that there is going to be a great famine over the land of Judea. And the church there at Antioch takes up a collection. And they send that collection by the hands of Barnabas and Saul. to take it to Jerusalem. And I say to myself, now, why would they have selected Barnabas? Surely it's related to the fact that he was one who had done similar things to meet the needs of others. Indeed, a great man. But I face up to something that I guess I've mentally tried to avoid. By the way, I went back and read my sermon, my latest sermon back yonder, and I said to myself, you know, you had some fairly good arguments there, but I can't even convince myself anymore that it was quite as easy as that. What I really wanted to do was to come out of an unpleasant situation, and rather than have to choose and say, Paul was wrong or Barnabas was wrong, I wanted to have this nice warm feeling that both of them were right. And that I could leave it at that, but I've just come to struggle with the text a little bit on that count. Look at what Luke does. Luke chapter 15, we have the account of two disagreements. We have the disagreement that takes place in Jerusalem, beginning at Antioch, but carried to Jerusalem, that has to do with whether or not Gentile Christians have to become Jews, law-abiding Jews, in order to be saved. Do they have to be circumcised, and are they required to keep the law? Some Jews were saying that. And Paul and Barnabas had taken them on to Antioch. The church at Antioch had wisely sent them on to Jerusalem, and the issue had been decided. There were strong differences. Would you not agree? Very strong differences over this issue, and there undoubtedly was strong and heated debate on the subject. Much of the discussion is left out. Lucky for us, we probably wouldn't find it edifying to read. But what we do know is that there were huge theological issues. Is the gospel of grace, or is the gospel a gospel of faith in Jesus plus works? If it is that, then that changes everything. Can Gentiles be brought into the faith as Gentiles by simply trusting Jesus, or must they become Jewish proselytes like they used to be, in order to be true Christians? Huge implications, and really the expansion of the gospel to the uttermost part, if you want to see it that way from Acts 1:8, is contingent upon this decision. When you come to the end, you discover that the whole church comes to a unanimous decision. Now, would you not call that nigh unto miraculous? When you look at that much division and that many people, the fact that all those people were guided by God into a unanimous decision is pretty unusual. And, frankly, it feels good. I read that, and I feel really good about it. We write this letter having unanimously agreed that this is the verdict that we have come to. Saved by faith alone, apart from works. A letter is written, and four men are commended to take its message to the Gentile churches, Judas, Silas, Barnabas, and Paul. And it's interesting that when they write this letter, and that's why I asked Hampton to read verses 22 and following, it says, from the apostles and elders, your brothers, to the Gentile brothers and sisters in Antioch, Syria, and Cilicia. And that is going to play out for me because Barnabas leaves before that job is done. Now, here's the things that I find myself troubled about. Strong differences between Barnabas and Paul. Apparently a heated argument. We're graciously kept from that. And the two-part paths. But here are the things that have just caused me to be a little uneasy with my two heroes who both come away untarnished from this debate, this disagreement, this split. It was Paul's idea. Paul suggested to Barnabas, let's return and let's visit the churches that we have planted earlier in the first missionary journey. It was not Barnabas's idea, and Barnabas doesn't complete it. The bottom line is the mission that he proposed Barnabas did not complete. Paul did. Now, you may say, well, there were other things for him to do. There may have been, but our text does not tell us that. As a matter of fact, tradition says that Barnabas went back to Cyprus and died there. So we really don't know what Barnabas did. What we do know in the book of Acts is we leave Barnabas here and we never see him again. But we see Paul, and he dominates the remainder of the book. So that certainly has something to suggest itself to us, perhaps. The Jerusalem Council set this up, and they set it up in such a way that they said, here are the churches that this letter is to be delivered to, and here are the men who will deliver it. And then one of those men drops out, Barnabas, and doesn't complete the things that the letter itself said would be completed. Paul moves ahead with his mission, which gets modified, but he moves ahead with the commendation of the church. Somebody pointed that out to me years ago when I did my last message on it, and I just sort of mentally just erased that. Said, doesn't matter. But the church commended Paul and Silas. It just says Barnabas left. And by the way, Barnabas did not replace someone. Paul immediately replaced Barnabas with Silas, and he very shortly, as we will discover, replaced John Mark with Timothy. He just takes, Barnabas just takes John Mark, his cousin, back to Cyprus. And I'm just saying, somehow it doesn't feel as good to me. I'm not trying to throw rocks, and I don't want to say more than Luke says. The scholars have lots to say about all of this. They love to create arguments between apostles. But I'm simply saying that it's not quite as neat and clean to me as it seems like it might be. So, what do we do with this? Well, let's look at the text and see if we can come to some kind of resolution. And I guess what I'm saying is, why did Luke purposely put one horrible theological argument with unbelievable negative possibilities that gets beautifully solved alongside of a personal disagreement that doesn't? That's my tension. Why does he set these two side by side? One argument that's wonderfully settled, the other one that just leaves you feeling queasy about it, as though it's not quite as neat as it should be. Now, look with me at verse 36. After some days, Paul said to Barnabas, "Let's return and visit the brothers in every town where we proclaimed the word of the Lord to see how they are doing." I noticed almost all the translations use the word visit. I don't know why. The word visit's just wimpy to me. And it is because the word that is used here it strikes me as a stronger word. Jesus says in Matthew chapter 25, "When I was sick, you came and visited me. When I was in prison, you came and visited me." James says, "What is true religion but to visit orphans and widows?" Folks, it isn't going in saying, "Hi, how you doing?" It's help. It's going to see what needs are there and ministering. Now, all right, maybe we from the context ought to have enough sense to figure that out. But what I'm saying is, this is a pastor's heart. We were there. We spread the gospel. People came to faith. Churches have been born. We need to go see how they're doing. And remember that one of the things that they are going to do that is paramount in their purpose structure is we need to deliver this letter from the apostles, which makes it clear to Gentile Christians and Gentile churches that what the Judaizers are going to say, if they've not already done so, is false. So it is a very important mission. It is a very important thing to go back to this church, these churches that were founded in the first journey, and to give them this message that has been sent, this letter that has been sent by the apostles. Barnabas is certainly willing to do that, but he is very committed to the fact that John Mark, his cousin, should come along too. And Paul insists, or keeps insisting, that they should not take along this one who had left them. That's a little wimpy too. Let's call it deserted. It's really the word from which we get apostasy. Mark bailed out when the going got tough. He didn't just leave. He deserted at a time when they needed. And that's Paul's argument. He bailed out when it got tough, and he did not go with us into the ministry where the going was tougher. So why take him with us now? So you've got two people, and I would agree that both of them have a point of view. Should we write Mark off? No. But should Mark go on that mission? Paul says, absolutely not. He had one opportunity, and this is not the place to put him right back into the battle where it's going to get worse. Paul, remember, was stoned and left for dead. The going gets very tough. Mark did not need to fail again. And it seems to me that when Barnabas takes Mark and goes back to Cyprus, he makes Mark his ministry. Maybe I'm wrong, but that's the only thing I see him doing. Now, you're going to say to me, yes, but 2 Timothy chapter 4 and verse 11, Paul says, be sure to bring along Mark, for he is beneficial for me. Absolutely. I agree with that completely. Beneficial for what? What he doesn't say is, I'm heading back into dangerous territory. I really would like Mark to go along. Paul's in prison. Mark has a beneficial ministry to do, but folks, it is not the ministry that they were going to do in the second missionary journey. Yes, Mark has value. He has a ministry to do, but I don't think it is going under the front lines. And Paul certainly didn't at this point think it was for him either. They part ways. Each sets out their own way. Paul chose Silas and set out, commended to the grace of the Lord. By the way, that's a key word. Commended to the grace of the Lord as he goes out by the brothers. And he passed through Syria and Cilicia, strengthening the churches. Here's where Silas gets introduced. He's also known as Silvanus. And it occurs to me that in the providence of God, it may well be, well, it obviously was, he was the better one to be with Paul in this next journey. For example, when you come to the occasion where Paul and Silas are going to be beaten, Paul's going to raise the question, do you do this to those who are Roman citizens? It seems apparent that Silas was a Roman citizen. We know Paul was. We don't know that Barnabas was. It could have been very different just as to what passport, so to speak, you held. So the providence of God is clearly at work here. One of the things I wanted to say is I don't think this is a perfect scenario. And in my years of life in a church, I have to say I don't recall me ever doing anything perfectly. I'm going to go home this afternoon, and I'm going to think all kinds of bad thoughts about what I could have said, what I should have said, and what I did say. It always happens. Nobody does anything perfectly. In fact, my wife said to me this morning, I always warn her, you know, I'm going to get clothes on, I'm putting on, and I give her one chance, and then it's when it's on, it's on. And so she looks at me in the light and says, oh, I didn't realize those pants were brown. And somehow something doesn't match. And I said to her, that doesn't matter. I'm going to tell them today, nobody's perfect. And you'll believe it. Nobody is perfect, and nobody does anything perfectly. I don't care what it is. I have never seen anything done perfectly in the church. No one is perfect. Nobody does everything perfectly. The beauty of it is God works anyway. It doesn't excuse our imperfection. It simply says God is not limited to our perfection, fortunately, or he would be doing nothing. Here's another one. No one is irreplaceable. You know, think about it. Sometimes we get the Elijah complex. Oh, Lord, I alone am left. And the inference is, when I'm gone, the world's in a lot of trouble. I mean, how fast? You know, it's like Barnabas has got his resignation, and Paul says, okay, Silas, let's get going. And they're off on their way. Nobody is irreplaceable. My goodness, off they go. So they're on their way, and notice a couple of more things. They pass through Syria and Cilicia. That, remember, is part of the geography that was supposed to be covered with this letter that had been sent by the apostles. Syria and Cilicia is the place where it's sort of Paul's home turf. And Syria and Cilicia are those places where Paul went, Acts chapter 9, after he had been in Jerusalem and they snuck him out of town and he went off. And Galatians chapter 1 tells us he spent some time here. This is not, Syria and Cilicia was not visited on the first missionary journey. And yet there are churches there who are built up and strengthened by this encouraging word from the apostles in Jerusalem. And I would suggest to you, it's likely that those churches were founded by Paul. So that when in Acts 13 the Spirit says, set apart for me Barnabas and Saul for the work to which I have called them, there it is. They'd already been there. But now they needed to go back and strengthen them. Notice, as I pointed out last week, grace encourages. Grace strengthens. You'll find several times in this text, the people, when they receive the letter, they are encouraged, they are strengthened, and the church grows. Legalism does not strengthen and it does not encourage. It just puts on a good front. Grace encourages. All right, let's look now at chapter 16 and verse 1. He also came to Derbe and Lystra. A disciple named Timothy was there, the son of a Jewish woman who was a believer, but whose father was a Greek. The brothers in Lystra and Iconium spoke well of him. Paul wanted Timothy to accompany him, and so he took him and circumcised him because of the Jews who were in those places, for they all knew that his father was Greek. Now, a couple of things that you ought to notice. When John Mark deserted, he deserted at Perga. It was right on the coast of Asia Minor. He never even got into the really rough stuff. Timothy... There's a little question about when it says Derbe and Lystra. But do you remember where Lystra was and what happened there? Lystra's the place that Paul was stoned and left for dead. This is as tough as it gets. That's where Timothy is from. Do you understand, therefore, when the brethren in that area say, this is a promising young man that you ought to take with you? He's a great replacement for Mark. Would you not agree? Here's a man who has endured difficulty and resistance, and he's well spoken of by the believers that are there. Oh, one more thing. If you were to look at your map, you would notice that on the first missionary journey, Paul and Barnabas had gone across Cyprus to the western side, and then they sailed somewhat north, and they came down into these cities in Asia Minor from the north. So they were going south in their missionary journey. So you have Lystra in chapter 14. You have Lystra, then Derbe. Here you have Derbe and then Lystra. He's coming now from the south, and he's going the opposite direction. So he's covering the same churches, but he's going in reverse. So he comes first to these difficult places where he has been, and that's where he finds Timothy. Now, what you really all want to know is this. All right, so why in the world did Paul circumcise Timothy? Right? Is that what you want to know? Especially because of Galatians chapter 2, which seems to have happened prior to this, that at least is my understanding, and is the backdrop for the Jerusalem Council. And there Paul says, they wanted me to circumcise Titus. And I would not for a moment, yield the gospel. So what's the difference? The difference is, A, Titus is a Greek, not a Jew. If Jews want to be circumcised, that's fine. If Jews want to observe this, the Passover and so on, that's fine. As long as they don't see that as something that contributes in any legalistic way toward their commendation to God, that they don't see it as a good work for which they're rewarded. But Gentiles are not under that. That's what the Jerusalem decision was about. Gentiles don't have to become Jews. When Titus is on the spot, he was a Gentile, and the unbeliever, false teaching, legalistic Jews were saying he has to be circumcised or he'll never be a believer. He was the example of Acts 15, verse 1. Unless one is circumcised, he cannot be saved. So, of course, Paul cannot allow Titus to be circumcised. Timothy is half Jew, half Greek. And the text tells us that because everybody knew his father was a Greek, then they're looking at him, and the question is, can he, for instance, accompany Paul into the synagogue? Can he, without hindrance, go and proclaim the gospel? It wasn't that these were unsaved Jews who said, I won't listen to Timothy unless he's circumcised because he can't be saved. These are unbelieving Jews. And Paul says in 1 Corinthians 9, I'll set anything aside if it doesn't violate principle. I'll set aside my rights. I'll live as a Gentile or I'll live as a Jew in order to further the gospel. So Paul's concern here is not that people are demanding circumcision in order for Timothy to be a believer or regarded as one. This is for him to have entrance into synagogues and wherever where he can preach with Paul. So it's not, the gospel is not the issue at stake. And the difference is, the people who are Jews, one is a legalistic Jew who demands circumcision. The other is just an unbelieving Jew who has prejudices about who he listens to. So it's no problem for Timothy to be circumcised and to identify himself then, I think, with the Jewish side of his family, if you want to put it that way. He has made his identity and he may go with Paul, who is, of course, a Jew of the Jews. That's at least my explanation for what takes place. Now, look with me at verses 6 through 10, because this is going to get Paul into Macedonia. Up to this point, Paul has virtually been retracing his steps. I've suggested that some of those steps were steps that he took before the first missionary journey, and others, these other cities, Lystra and Derbe, would be cities that he did during his journey. Now God is going to work in a providential way. No, he's going to work in a non-providential way, in a supernatural way, to direct the steps of Paul and Silas to Europe, where they never intended to go. They had expressed their intent, and you'll see this with Paul all the time. He says, if the Lord wills, here's what I'm going to do. Paul had it in his mind that he was going to visit those churches, and that was the end of it. God said, actually, I have something a little more in mind for you. Something he never imagined. But God was extending the gospel in fulfillment of his purposes and his command in Acts chapter 1, verse 8. Verse 6, they went through the region of Phrygia and Galatia, having been prevented by the Holy Spirit from speaking the message in the province of Asia. So they're trying to go up to Asia, basically north and a little bit west. They're trying to go up into Asia, and they're prevented. Wouldn't you like to know how? Come on, you're snoopy and curious like me, aren't you? Why do you suppose we're not told? It doesn't matter for us, does it? It doesn't matter for us unless it is just our curiosity, or unless somehow we find some formula so that we can do that same thing and God's going to tell us exactly which way to go, what pair of shoes to put on, which way to drive to church, where to go eat lunch after church. We would love to have that information. And notice that a book that is talking about the Holy Spirit and the divine intervention in the affairs of men specifically keeps us from data that we don't need to know. These are critical times. This is crucial as to where the gospel is going to go, and God secures His purposes by revelation. But it doesn't have to happen to us that way. And if it needs to happen, it will. But I would suggest you don't tell too many people how it happened with you. Because He will work with people as He needs to. And you will notice that He also works with people in ways that aren't necessarily supernatural interventions. Would you not agree with me that as we approach this text where there is divine intervention, would you not agree with me that God was at work in the argument at the Jerusalem Council? Would you not agree with me that in spite of the bad taste that is still in my mouth about the argument between Paul and Barnabas, would you not agree with me that God orchestrated and worked through those events to achieve exactly what He wanted to happen? It wasn't beautiful. It was kind of messy, but it came out exactly the way God purposed that it would. Now we have God specifically giving revelation, and at first it's negative. These are what some people call closed doors. I don't know what happened, but I have to believe, knowing Paul, I mean, he is like a bull in a china shop. For him not to preach anywhere takes some kind of first-class intervention. Whatever it was, God did it, and they didn't preach the gospel in Asia. And then they try, when they come to, I always say Mysia, but I think Hampton's right, Mysia. They attempt to go into Bithynia, which is up again, and maybe a little to the east. And the Spirit of Jesus did not allow them to do this. So twice the Spirit of God intervenes and prevents them from proclaiming the gospel in a way you and I will never know. But what it means is, not here, not here. And pretty soon, they find themselves at Troas on the Aegean Sea. And they don't. It's like Moses and the Israelites at the Red Sea. Where do you go? Well, they're wondering that question. And this is a quantum leap for them. And it's at this point that God supernaturally reveals His plan to Paul. A vision, verse 9. A vision appeared to Paul during the night. A Macedonian man was standing there urging him, "Come over to Macedonia and help us." After Paul saw the vision, we attempted immediately to go over to Macedonia, concluding that God had called us to proclaim the good news to them. When this follows through, they will end up at Philippi. It does not say, so far as I can see, "Come over to Philippi and help us." Once again, Paul and Silas and the team will make strategic decisions that aren't necessarily revealed. But God has given the big picture, and that is, this is the area that I now want you to go to. You need to move up in the direction of Europe and proclaim the gospel there. And, of course, that opens the door for all that is to follow. Now, let me talk about how this text fits together and what it now says to me. One of the things that I think I find in this text is an evidence for the believability of the Bible. One of the reasons why I played out my scenario of the tabloid and whatever is, wouldn't this have been an excellent opportunity for Luke to have editorialized? Now remember, Luke is Paul's buddy. We're coming to the section where it's going to be not "they did this and that," but "we did this and that." Luke was a traveling companion for Paul. How easy it would have been for Luke to have painted the kind of picture that makes Paul look wonderful and makes Barnabas look awful and ugly and glamorize that. Or he could have painted the picture about all of this supernatural revelation and how God guided, and he could have really jazzed it up to where it would be so spectacular even the televangelists would get excited about it. About what God is doing to reveal and display His will to people. This text says to me, the Bible is believable. He doesn't glamorize, He doesn't editorialize, and He doesn't sensationalize. He just says what needs to be said, and He doesn't tell us those things which will lead us down a path which is really unhealthy for us into some kind of sensationalism. I think that what we need to see in this text, too, is, and it surely is a text about guidance. Ray Stedman, I think, calls this "How God Guides." And he gives this scenario of God guiding all the way from these details of a human argument and some other things that are preventions that we don't really even understand to supernatural revelation of this Macedonian vision. The whole spectrum. I think what I would like to do is make a distinction between divine guidance and divine direction. I think that divine guidance, what we mean by that, and what we often ask is, how can I know the will of God? And the assumption is that somehow God is going to lay out for us a map that tells us exactly what He is going to do and exactly what our part is. I don't see a lot of that in the Bible. God says to Abraham, I want you, Abram, I want you to leave your family, leave your homeland, and go to a place that I'll tell you about. Or he says to him in Genesis chapter 15, for some time after you are gone, there is going to be, your people are going to go and they are going to spend time in a foreign country. And they will be there and it will be 400 years when they come out. He doesn't say Egypt. Because frankly, Abram doesn't need to know that. And it's not the time for him to know that. God divinely guides men at critical points. Where they need revelation, He does it. But at other points, He directs. And we may not see His hand. And I'm saying, I think God was directing through this argument of Barnabas and Paul. I'm not saying God made them argue. I'm saying God used that scenario to bring about direction so that now a new missionary team is formed that is precisely suited for going into these areas where they went in the second missionary journey. I think most of us are looking for divine guidance all the time. We want one of those GPS things in our Bible. And it says, you are now here, and now you need to turn here and go this far. It isn't like that, folks. Acts chapter 1 and verse 8 tells us, like a compass, here is where God is going to go. The gospel is going to be preached in Jerusalem, in all Judea and Samaria, and the uttermost part of the earth. That's the general global plan. God then divinely works. Acts chapter 8, verse 1. He brings about persecution through the death of Stephen. Who would have thought of that? And it's because of that that the church at Antioch is born. And it's because of that that these other churches are begotten. God is working providentially, and He is directing, but He is not guiding in the sense of saying, here's exactly what I'm doing. Because we walk a walk of faith. And we must trust that even those ugly things in our lives, those things that are uncomfortable and that we really would rather not ponder too long, God is using those to bring us to the point where we need to be. Here's another thought. One of my problems, I'm really asking myself, this is sort of a psychoanalysis. Why, you know, as the psalmist say, you know, why are you cast down, oh my soul? What, I'm saying to myself, Debbie, what is your problem with this text? What is your problem? Here's one of my problems. I like to idolize men. I think all of us do. I like to idolize men. I like heroes. And Barnabas was mine. And it makes me mad that Luke messes up his image. And even as much as I like him, I'm not sure I can defend him entirely. I'm not saying he was entirely wrong. I'm saying that it just wasn't a nice, neat package where you say, oh, this makes me feel so good. I don't think you can. And when we idolize men, we make idols. And I think one of the things that the Bible consistently does is say, do not place your trust in men. Any man. Any man. But I think there's a way in which we look around and we say, look at this wonderful work over here. And we find a man, and we let him write a book, and then we read it, and we do what he did. And we're looking around for men to idolize. When we ought to be saying, I really think this is an evidence of God. And in fact, if you knew those men as well as their wives knew those men, you would know it was God who gets the glory. You would know that. Men are made of clay. Haddon Robinson used to say, I don't have feet made of clay. I'm clay all the way to my armpits. I'm clay to the top of my head. He doesn't use perfect men. And we dare not idolize men because they are not God. Now, here's the thing that finally soaked through my head as I was looking at this. Why does he put this argument between Barnabas and Paul right after the debate in Jerusalem? And it kind of knock, knock, and you say, what was the issue? What was the issue of the theological debate in Jerusalem? It was the grace of God. Was it not? Are men saved by grace through faith, or are they saved by faith plus works? It was the grace of God. They commended Paul and Silas to the grace of God. We sang two songs this morning that said, service is by grace. Not just salvation, service is by grace. My friends, we live and work and serve by grace. And yet, we go about our service as though unless it is perfect, God can't use it. Well, if He saved us that way, we'd be in hell. And if He was dependent upon perfection in our ministry and our service, everybody else would be there too. He works through grace. And it doesn't have to be perfect. I'm not saying you make it sloppy to be spiritual. I'm saying no matter what our best efforts are, our service has flaws. And God works in spite of those flaws, even through those flaws, and He gets the job done, and He gets the glory. What great leader do you know of in the Bible who comes out just pristine? You have to say to yourself, you look at David, wow, David and the Goliath. Yeah, right. Read on. Solomon, read on. Elijah, read on. You just find clay everywhere. And it seems to me, here's my summation. This account is not about the greatness of men. It is about the grace of God. Here I was disappointed because my hero wasn't perfect, and they had just said, you don't have to work to get there. You don't have to be perfect to get there. God saves by grace. And here I am agonizing because it's only grace. My hero comes away tarnished, whether it's Paul or whether it's Barnabas or whoever it is. They get tarnished. Who are you looking at? And what is the basis? Grace is the basis for service. Why are spiritual gifts called charismata? Why are they called grace manifestations? Because we serve by grace. I think maybe it'll take... I remember one time I was employed at a certain place, and it had its own unique characteristics. And I remember a fellow that he and I were talking, and he said, you know, I think I know why God has me here. I'm a perfectionist. Well, let me tell you, brothers and sisters, by the time he got through with that employment, he wasn't. What you see is God places us in situations where we say, that person wasn't perfect. This scenario wasn't perfect. They didn't do this just right. And you know what? God worked anyway. And look what God has done. Last, this account is not about the greatness of men. It is about the greatness of God. I remember one of my friends in the audience saying about a particular sermon. Fortunately, I had not delivered it. It could have been mine, believe me. But I said to this person, what did you think? And they responded, too much man. Too much man. Not enough God. That was my problem. I was looking at men. What the marvel of this text is to say, God is so great. God is so powerful. God is so gracious that He uses people like you and me. And our imperfect service. Please, this is not a sermon on sloppiness, on doing badly. It is simply saying, no matter how well we do, it isn't good enough. Only grace will do it. Now, we've been talking about service today and not salvation, but I can't end without saying grace is the key to the whole Christian life. The last message we had was about people who were trying somehow to earn merit with God by circumcision and law-keeping. And the point of that was, and the apostle said, nobody's ever been able to live up to the law. Nobody's ever been able to achieve that. The only way one can be saved, as Peter says, is we are saved by faith just like they, the Gentiles, are. As a matter of fact, in Romans chapter 10, Paul says the problem with Jews is they were trying to earn God's righteousness. That was their problem. You can only receive righteousness as a gift by faith. It is Jesus who is perfect. It is He who is flawless. It is His death and resurrection that saves us. If you have not trusted in Him, give up on works, friend. It won't work. It won't. You can't serve God by works. You can't be saved by works. It is only grace. And thank God for that. Father, thank You for this text. Thank You for Barnabas and Paul. Thank You for even showing to us that perhaps they're not perfect men. But in spite of all that, You worked in a way to take the gospel to lost souls. People were saved. Churches were planted. And You received the glory. May that be the message for us as well. Help us not to look to men. Help us not to focus on men who are fallible, but to focus on Jesus and to serve by grace. In His name we pray. Amen.